before the pandemic, we're all juggling, you know, X number of balls. But the pandemic has forced us to say, okay, which are the fragile balls that I have to hold on to and keep in the air? And which are the ones that I can set down? It's focused our attention to those fragile balls, those most important priorities in our lives. And when we look at things with more openness, more solutions may appear.
Welcome to the Mindspace Podcast. I'm Joe Flanders. Thanks for tuning in. The Mindspace Podcast is my personal, in-depth exploration of the science and practice of well-being. I'm sharing this journey with you because I believe we can all lead happier, more meaningful lives by getting the facts and training our minds. Join me as I learn and share the most inspiring insights about human flourishing from leading experts, because we could all use a little more Mindspace. My guest today is Dr. Tamara Soles. Tamara is a lovely human being. She is also a licensed psychologist specializing in child mental health and well-being. And she works a lot in coaching parents on how to best support their children's development and the development of resilience. We had a pretty good conversation about back-to-school anxiety and the unique challenges of back-to-school in this sort of COVID environment. We got a chance to talk about just back-to-school in general, what's challenging about it, what COVID-19 adds to this season, how she's coaching parents on coping with these challenges, in particular this process of making meaning out of what's been happening. We get into government regulations and school boards' approaches to helping foster safety in schools and perhaps some of the challenges that have come along with that. We also talk about some of the early warning signs that parents and teachers should be looking out for. And she gives some of her favorite tips on how to navigate back-to-school anxiety and how to think about disciplining and supporting kids through various challenges in general. So I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. And without any further delay, here's my conversation with Tamara. Dr. Tamara Soles, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to have this chat with you.
All right. I'm really happy to have the chance to talk to you. My impression is that you have thought a lot about and read a lot about this very topical, timely issue of back-to-school anxiety. So I'm really excited to get into it with you. Maybe you could just talk to us first about kind of your professional background and what you do and how you got there.
Sure. So my PhD was actually in educational and child clinical psychology. So what that means is that I have this marriage between both working directly with children and families, but also having this whole other educational psychology piece in my back pocket, which is certainly relevant at the current moment as school is on many people's minds. So that's my PhD. And then my specialization after finishing my doctorate was in early childhood mental health. So I work a lot on working with the families to support families to function better as a whole and to help parents understand how to use connection and what we know about the brain and how it develops to promote self-regulation and to harness the power of connection to make families thrive better. So in my practice, I work with a lot of families of kids of all ages, from, you know, little early childhood years all the way up to teens and even some 20-somethings who still act like teens sometimes. So I run the gamut, but certainly I get a lot of anxiety referrals. And so anxiety is a big part of my practice right now.
Cool. And I'll just make a plug for you and your practice and your clinic. You might be a little shy to do that, but everyone should know that I refer people to you all the time. I consider you really one of the leading child psychologists in our community here. And the fact that our offices are a couple of floors apart in the same building helps. But I even, you know, refer friends and family because I really have a lot of respect for the work you do. So Yeah, just to just mention how I think successful you are and how well qualified you are on this topic. If you're cool with that, I would ask you a bit of a more personal question. How have you and your family been dealing with the pandemic, the lockdown, and now the back to school experience? Like, what has it been like for you?
That's a great question, because as therapists, we don't talk a lot about ourselves. So I'm happy to talk about myself for a little bit. You know, for us, first of all, I recognize that we're incredibly lucky that I have a job that allows me the flexibility to work from home. And so although doing telehealth wasn't something that I did regularly in the past, and there's obviously a bit of a learning curve, but I've really embraced it. And because I do a lot of parent coaching, it has actually worked really, really well in that format. Parents don't have to worry about trying to park in Westmount or, you know, any of the other logistical barriers that often come up, like taking time out of work and the travel time, the commute. So for my job, it's worked really well. And my husband, he runs a visual effects company in Montreal, and he has never worked from home, but even he had to, and the company had to pivot really quickly, obviously, like many did. And he was able to see that a lot of his work could be done from home too, which has been a great thing for our family to see, wow, there's maybe more flexibility than we realized before. So that's been helpful. Having said that, I just couldn't practically see the same number of clients now as I did before, because my kids were home. So I have two, they're twins, a twin almost seven-year-olds. And so, you know, come March 13th, when everything shut down, I had to scale back. So I scaled back quite a bit in order to help with the schooling and just be home with the kids. But for me, again, I'm in a very privileged position that I was able to continue working. I could scale back and it not be dramatically affecting my family's day-to-day life with my husband working. So I feel very lucky to have been able to do that. But I certainly noticed that it reduced my stress tremendously to not have to worry about, you know, the commute back and forth to school and to work less and just concentrate on the clients that I did continue to see regularly, could really focus on them, but then still be completely present for most of the day with my kids. So for us, it has actually been a very positive experience in that we were able to find new ways of shifting and working for our family that seemed to have everyone be a bit more connected with each other and a bit less stress. So having said that, of course, then there's the stress of what to do come back to school time. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, hold on. I want to get to that, but I'm curious, yeah, over the course of the months, how have the twins adapted and coped? It sounds like the family's been pretty closely knit. Have there been ups and downs with the twins?
Oh, absolutely. absolutely. I mean, there's always ups and downs when you have any kids. But I would say, look, first of all, they're at an age where I found it was a particularly good age for them. If they had to experience this, it was a good age for it to happen, because they're at the stage where they'd been home with me much of their lives. That, you know, school was really kind of their first experience. They had been at preschool kind of part-time before that, but otherwise they'd always been home with me. So being home with me is kind of their jam. They're used to that. So it was nice to get back to that. Having said that, though, of course, there are times when, you know, we're managing they can't go out. They can't do as much as they normally would. There isn't the freedom and flexibility. And so sometimes that would lead to a little bit more frustration or stress. But because of the age that they're at, and as I said, because they're kind of used to being home with me, although they missed their friends, they have each other. And it wasn't as big of a deal as it is, as I've seen for some of my clients who are a bit older, or even some of my friends whose kids are a bit older, where their social lives are so much more amplified than they are for my kids, for example. So the ups and downs certainly have been, you know, dealing with obviously protecting my family's health and then my extended family. Like, how do we deal with keeping my parents safe and visiting or not? And all of those things that I think a lot of families are worrying about. But for the most part, the ups and downs were not that much greater than in everyday life, at least for my family. But I also know that's not the case for lots of other families.
Yeah, I think this is something that will probably come up, and it should come up, just this idea that there's a huge distribution, right? You talked about the age of the kids, the sort of baseline routines, how social kids are. And, you know, we're going to get into whether it's the pandemic in general or the back to school experience. It's really not one experience. It's really a heterogeneous kind of thing. So as much as we can, we'll try to take that diversity into account. And of course, we can't talk about everybody at once. So we'll do our best to kind of track all that. I think I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on the back to school moment in general, right? So every year at this time, you know, the media is just covered with back to school stories. I just did a TV news interview about it. It's in, you know, every clinic has a blog post about it. So maybe before we get into how this particular back to school season is unique, maybe just tell us, what are the challenges and opportunities of back to school generally?
Yeah, so that's a great point, because I think that there is a baseline anxiety for many kids and parents. And when I say anxiety, I'm not saying, you know, clinically significant levels of anxiety, but some nervousness and anxiety about, you know, who's going to be in my class? Who is my teacher? Am I going to get along with this teacher? And, you know, a lot of kids have that concern about jumping from a new, you know, to a new grade. And is the work going to be that much harder? And am I going to be able to handle this? And family stress about the routine that brings, having to get up early, having to get to bed by a certain time. So there's always a little bit of back to school stress for many families.
I would just add to that, what I experience and what I see is that it's also tough for the parents that are maybe coming off a vacation or a quieter period at work. And so they're trying to be available to support their kids, but it's also a transition for them.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, if kids have been in camp in the summer, then, you know, their whole routine looks very, very different. And they're also, you know, many kids have spent a lot of time outside and moving and all the things that they should be doing regularly and that are helpful. But now they shift back to, you know, somewhat more sedentary activities and more restriction. And I think that brings a lot of stress for families.
Mm-hmm. All right. So this, of course, is a very unusual back to school season. What are you seeing as like the main variables that COVID-19 is adding this time around?
Families are, first of all, having to make the choice of whether they feel safe sending their children back to school. And every family has their own risk threshold or risk tolerance level. But for many families, they've had to look at whether they feel comfortable with the government regulations or the individual school regulations. For those who have chosen to send their kids to school or who feel they're forced to and don't have other options, you know, they're contending with the worry that, is the classroom bubble going to be truly a safe bubble? Are my kids going to be exposed to the virus in ways that are so quick and hard to stop? You know, once one kid goes home with the sniffles, is it too late? You know, they're worried, obviously, about their children and their family's safety. But then on top of it, the logistical things. Is it going to feel like school for a kid to be sitting there in a classroom with a teacher with a mask and possibly a visor too, and these different groups and possibly wearing masks themselves and not being able to have the same equipment or tools in some of the rooms? The rooms look different. They're organized differently. So on top of that, it's, how is my kid going to adjust to the practical changes of school and the overall feeling of school? You know, a lot of families have said it doesn't feel warm and nurturing, and the teachers can't give my kid a hug if they need it. So there's a lot of concerns of just even if the logistical preventative measures are effective, what is the climate of school going to do to my children and my family?
Right. So I'm guessing you're providing a fair bit of counseling to parents these days about these decisions. First of all, is that a fair assumption? And what kind of approach are you taking to guiding these parents?
So first of all, helping parents see that there is no one size fits all answer, and that to have compassion for each other and for themselves in trying to make decisions with limited information, and that, you know, it is hard to make a decision when we feel like the information is incomplete or it's ever changing. And so everyone is just trying to do the best they have, you know, they can with the information they have. And so I take the approach of figuring out what works for one person's or one family's safety risk and threshold and a child's learning needs. But I think that one of the things that has happened over the pandemic, similar to how I described for my family, is that it has forced families to look at what are their priorities and what do they need. You know, I've likened it to juggling balls. So before the pandemic, we're all juggling, you know, X number of balls. But the pandemic has forced us to say, okay, which are the fragile balls that I have to hold on to and keep in the air? And which are the ones that I can set down? And so it's focused our attention to those fragile balls, those most important priorities in our lives. But the great part of that is that it allows us to be very intentional about which balls we reintroduce. And so because a lot of us have started to learn, okay, maybe I can work from home, or maybe my schedule can shift a little bit more than I thought it could before, then we look at things like, well, are there other educational options for my child that I might not have considered in, you know, were it not for the situation? So looking at homeschooling or learning pods, or just the variety of way that learning can look, and maybe changing schools, or like I said, it's allowed people to reflect differently on what their families need and how that can look. And when we look at things with more openness, more solutions may appear. So that's how I've been working with families and looking at what works for you, what is your priority right now, and helping them with their own anxieties about what it means for their child if they're learning in a different environment, or if learning looks different than the traditional learning, and will they still learn, and will that impact them down the line 4 years from now if they've missed 4 months of schooling, for example. So
this is really interesting stuff. And I want to come back to this question about how the government is handling things and how the schools are handling things. But I want to linger here for a second, because I know that you are sort of like, you encourage people to pay attention to and be in touch with the silver linings, right, in the experience that we've been having over the last few months. And I certainly, speaking personally, like, have found the process you described to be incredibly helpful for me and my family. It's just like when the pandemic first hit, it's like everything became simplified, right? Yeah. Not leaving the house. We got to go get groceries is pretty much it. And that simplification brought certain things into focus, brought a certain clarity around priorities in life. And I found it incredibly energizing. And then this intentionality around reintroducing more complexity has been really interesting. So maybe you can say more about that. And I also just want to just qualify as well that I'm just aware that different people have different, you know, different silver linings, and some people have much less, right? So just to be able to talk about the privilege of simplifying and enjoying and then adding complexity, like, you know, as I said, it's just sort of a privilege to be able to do that. And I don't know, is it the case that everybody has a silver lining, or are some people really stuck in very complex circumstances and don't really have the flexibility that, let's say, you and I are enjoying?
Certainly the phrase that has been used often through the pandemic of we're all in the same storm, but maybe in different boats, is very apt. So not everyone enjoys the privilege that you just described. And I tend to think of it less as a silver lining and more as meaning making. Mm-hmm. And that is accessible to everybody. So I think everyone has the opportunity to make meaning from what has happened in the last, you know, 6 months. What they do with that meaning may vary, and the capacity to do different things with that meaning may vary. But I think there is opportunity to make meaning from it for everyone. Now,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, can everybody, you know, shift their work schedules and, you know, change how they work? No, not necessarily. And many people have lost jobs. Some people have lost lives. Obviously, this has been an incredibly traumatizing time for many people. At the same time, even through trauma, there is opportunity for meaning making. But I do like to help parents see that there are often, as I said, more opportunities than they have been aware of in the past. And that might, you know, it's probably a bit reductive to say there's always a choice, but for the sake of ease, I will say there's almost always a choice to be made. You might not like the consequences of those choices, or those consequences might be quite involved. So for example, if, you know, I'll take a more extreme example, if a family is super busy and they're, you know, they are working long hours and their children are in school and then after school programs, and then they're finding themselves rushed to pick their kid up and then take them to hockey and get their homework done and then come home, and they're finding that they're constantly in these power struggles with their kids. Well, yeah, like, no shit. Like, that's going to happen, because the foundation of a relationship is connection. And when your lives don't have room for connection, then those things are going to go astray. So, and it's not, I'm not coming at that as a place of judgment about those lives. It's just, there are functional consequences to any of the structures of our lives. And so, yes, in some cases, a parent might say, well, I can't cut back my hours. Again, I'm going to go extreme just to make a point, but, you know, I can't cut back my hours and spend more time with my kids, because then I can't, you know, do X, Y, and Z, or maybe I'd have to move into a smaller house or get a different car, or, you know, really, really change my life in a dramatic way. But those changes may be possible, and those changes may be necessary in some cases. Now, by no means am I saying go quit your job, go move, and go, you know, change your life. But I say that only to say that there are options available for many people, and that this situation has caused people to look at their lives a bit differently and to see that maybe we don't need the extra lesson or the extra, you know, after school activity or sport or whatever it might be, because a lot of the challenges that I face in my clinical work have to do with overscheduling, not enough time, and rushing. Mm-hmm. And so often we need to look at what can we pare back, what can we reduce in order to make this family function a bit better. So all that to say, perhaps that's a long-winded way of saying that during this pandemic and as the shift back to school, you know, I think there is an opportunity for everyone to at least evaluate what do you have control over in your life. And yes, some people absolutely have more control over more things in their lives than others.
Yeah. I'm really with you on the meaning-making piece there. And the example you just gave, I think, is relevant to a lot of people and relevant to the kind of coaching I'm doing. I also think it applies very nicely to maybe something on the other end of the spectrum, which is like the Black Lives Matter protest, in the sense that people who joined those protests and became more active in that community were making meaning in a different way with very different circumstances. So I think it captures the choices that we're faced with in these circumstances for most people.
That's exactly right. And when we think about resilience building, having a higher purpose, and I don't mean that necessarily spiritually, but just a higher purpose larger than oneself, is one of the resilience factors. And so Black Lives Matter as a movement is an important contributor to resilience building, because it is people working toward supporting a community at large, or, you know, a group of people at large. So it's larger than oneself. It's not an individual. It's a more collective action. And so, again, that's making meaning. You know, I'm going to take these systemic biases, the oppression, the racism, the violence, and I'm going to make it meaningful in my life or in one's life by finding a way of pushing back or of speaking up or of engaging, whatever that is making meaning from even the most traumatizing situations in a way that is resilience promoting.
Mm-hmm. I could channel like some clients of mine, or even maybe some of our listeners or a part of my brain, and say like, okay, Tamara, that's really nice. You know, you're going to sit with clients and, you know, talk about the meaning that they're making out of this challenge and this kind of stuff. That's all well and good. But we're talking about a virus that could potentially kill you or your child. And even if you get it and survive, could have long-term consequences on your health. I was just reading last night about this hypothesis about how it affects your heart. And some people have inflammation in the heart muscle that lasts many, many months, if not years. Yeah. Can we really afford the sort of luxury of navel gazing and pontificating about the meaning of our lives when there are real health and safety issues here that we should really be focusing on perhaps a little bit more?
I think they're not mutually exclusive. So obviously, we are all existing in this global pandemic, and we have a choice to get overcome by the anxiety of how to navigate a global pandemic, or again, focus on what we have control over. And so I can't control where the virus is or whether it comes to me or not, but I can control what I do in response, which is true of any stressful situation. And stressful situation is obviously a massive understatement for the current reality. But in any given circumstance, I have the choice of how to respond to that situation. So if I'm navel gazing by going out without a mask and wandering through from bar to bar, that's a problem. But if I am reflecting on my life while living within the parameters that I have set up in order to keep my family or myself safe, then yeah, I don't see how those would be conflicting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about those parameters a little bit here. And I guess I should warn you and the listeners that this question may turn out to be a little bit more of a rant, but just to kind of get the conversation started, I've been tracking this back to school thing for, I guess, a few weeks now. And for the record, my eldest, who is sort of school age, is back in school. And, you know, I've got my own stresses about that, but generally support that decision. So in reading about this, it really doesn't seem that complicated to get kids back to school safely. And I'm not an expert here. I don't know all the variables, but it strikes me that there are a small number of variables that have become relatively clear in the literature that apply to how, you know, the, like what you need to do to keep kids safe. And it's, you know, something along the lines of smaller class sizes, like don't put kids in a class with more than like 10 other children or something. They've got to wear masks. You've got to sort of manage these bubbles carefully. There may be a couple of other like basic things. And if you do that, kids and teachers don't get sick. And if you don't do those things, everybody gets sick. It's just like that's kind of the story that's emerged from school openings all over the world.
Yeah.
And if I look around what's happening, you know, here in Montreal, I can maybe speak to this, the circumstances in my kid's school or even maybe across the city or the province, it's like minimal investment in these things. And, you know, if I look across, I guess there's, again, sort of variability across jurisdictions and provinces and countries and this kind of thing, but I don't get it. What is going on? What is your take on how governments in general, school boards, and perhaps even our local sort of organizing bodies are managing this, and why is it not being done more carefully?
It's hard not to be cynical, I think, as we certainly in Quebec, as we watch how the government has handled the pandemic really from the beginning. And I'll use the summer camps as an example. When we release guidelines about reduced ratios in summer camps, and then summer camps say, wait, we can't afford to run if we're going to have those kinds of ratios. And then the government turns around and says, never mind, back to regular ratios. I think that's a very clear indication that there's more going on in these decisions than just safety. And so I think, so it's, like I said, it's hard not to be cynical, but I think that's realistic that these decisions are being made on multiple levels from multiple perspectives. And as you said, there has been some pretty clear precautions that can be put in place. And yet the reduced class sizes don't seem to be happening to the degree that would be most helpful. Even wearing the masks is definitely variable between schools, even though the government has now come out and said you can't force any kid at any age to wear a mask, which has put schools in a difficult position where I think a lot of schools are doing we previously told you that you must wear masks from this grade and up, and we're not saying anything about this new announcement from the government. So, you know, I don't know why. I know that the government has been obviously pushing for more economic growth and recovery. And I think the agenda, from my perspective, based only on my own, you know, individual person reading of the situation, seems to be that they need to get people back to work so that people can get back to working downtown, going into stores, spending, buying lunches, paying for parking. And in order to do that, they need people working to get, to do that, they need people working and they need parents to have their kids somewhere. Mm-hmm. So I think while at the same time, there is a strong sort of media push about the necessity to get kids back to school for their own mental health, which I'm sure we'll talk about. So the government, I think, has been towing that line as well. We need to get kids back. It's for their own best interest. But I think there's also the economic push. And then on top of that, the other line that is being put out there regularly is this schools as a societal safety net idea. In other words, we need to get kids back into school because many of them are in situations at home where they are exposed to relational violence or aggression or poverty, or they're missing meals that they would normally get at school, which is also problematic for many reasons. But I think there's a lot of agendas that are being used to perpetuate the implementation of these plans, mm-hmm. And not the least of which financial. I mean, to take class sizes that were already too big in many schools and reduce them to those levels means having space and, you know, shifting education in terms of why are we not thinking about being outside more in terms of their education. You know, we know enclosed spaces for long periods of time is one of the, you know, biggest promoters of the virus, you know, being more contagious and transmitting. Mm-hmm. But there's not a lot of talk about being outside for education more, yep. At least not that I've seen. Yep. So I don't know if I have answers, but that's my take.
Well, it's interesting. I want to pick up on this thing about how it's easy to be cynical. And I guess my own view here is that I want my government to be considering all of these variables.
Yeah.
The safety of my kid is obviously a high priority. but so has the sort of long-term economic consequences of a totally shuttered economy, because my kids are going to be the ones paying down the debt for the rest of their lives and having worse public services as a consequence. So I'm all for that. And I'm not cynical about it. And I mean, I'll let you speak, you know, maybe nuance your point a little bit more if you want. I guess I'll, my issue here is that the communication's been so lousy. It's like, tell me why these are the decisions that you've landed on and why you changed your mind from a month ago and why the school seems to be in the dark about the reasons for these decisions. And I was chatting with another parent last night, and like, she just wants to know, like, she can get on board with whatever the plan is. And she's not, you know, she sort of described herself as relatively conformist. Like, she'll go along, but she just wants to know. And having the information would be a source of kind of security and comfort. And I'm again, I don't want to, you know, be critical. I'm sure this is an impossible job for any government. But that's part something I'm genuinely confused about. That, of course, there are many variables, but like, talk to us, tell us what's going on, and tell us how you're balancing these different considerations.
Right. And to your point, I think, I mean, look, I agree with you, obviously, that they need to factor in many things, but I'm not sure that those things are all factored equally. And obviously, any individual is going to have a different idea of the weight of each of those variables. But I think there is the lack of transparency about those variables, which is similar to what you're saying. And I think that's what a lot of people are concerned about. So the cynicism, I suppose, is coming more from the, like, let's call a spade a spade. If we're doing it for this reason, let's say it's this reason, or this is why we're changing, you know, the guidelines. So it's not that I don't want them to consider all of those factors. But I think there's some cherry picking that's going on about which factors sort of promote the overall agenda anyway. But to your point, the lack of communication is a huge one. And I think the fact that it was really down to the wire for families to even know, well, are we going back to school? What is that going to look like?
Right.
Are they masks? Like, all of that was just ridiculous.
Yes, I agree. I agree. Am I going to have to stay home, you know, 2 days a week because my kid's not going to have school? Like, I need to know that like months in advance, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And for anyone, again, for anyone who doesn't, you know, doesn't have the luxury of a job like we do with some relative flexibility, you know, how are they planning for their lives if they don't even know, you know, when ideas like some days on, some days off are bandied around, how on earth is that functional for most families, you know, or half days or mornings and then afternoons, you know, and to not even know those things with any preparation is again, ridiculous and very anxiety producing also, obviously, for families. And I think the thing that I'm hearing most from families is that they felt like they really just didn't have choice, that they really hoped that distance learning would be an option. And yeah, who wouldn't hope that that was an option, right? They, you know, I'm not saying that that is the right option for everybody, but to have that as an option, I think a lot of parents were really hoping that that was going to be implemented, and not just for kids whose health conditions or families' conditions require it, but as an actual choice. So to be able to say, I don't feel safe even with these government measures sending my child, so, you know, I'm going to avail myself of this distance learning opportunity. I know a lot of families were disappointed that that wasn't available for them.
I'd be curious, maybe just briefly, because there's so much other stuff I want to ask you about, but again, lingering here for a second, how are you approaching coaching parents around like working through the disappointment, the cynicism? Are we back to focus on what is in your control and accept and let go what isn't? Is that the general frame you're taking, or how do you deal with that?
So certainly there's the element of the control piece, but then also relatedly, you know, rather than just acceptance, what can you do? Can you organize? Can you, you know, do you feel like you need to express yourself by creating a petition or writing a letter? Or, you know, how do you advocate for your family's needs? Or can you advocate within your school? Or, you know, at what level can you take some action, at least to say, it may not have achieved the results that I had hoped for, but at least I took some action in service of what I perceived my child's needs to be. And so just supporting families in connecting with each other and mobilizing if that's what is helpful for them, or for other families, as you said, it's sort of grieving the loss of what they hoped their school year would look like for their kids, and grieving the loss of that safety that we generally feel living in Canada, sending our kids to a public school or to a school in general. You know, there is a loss of safety that comes from that, even when they are taking the preventative measures. And so, yes, there's room for grief and there's room for processing that. But at the same time, also helping families take action if that's something that they feel would be helpful, or just connecting with other parents who are also in a similar situation and being able to support each other in that way.
Yeah. I'm aware that what I'm about to sort of ask you about might be, you know, a little bit off of the kind of out of your wheelhouse in terms of your expertise, but probably something that comes up in your personal reflections or some of the deeper conversations with clients. I think also what I'm about to say is probably not very PC, but it's something that I think about as well. And that is the bigger picture, the broader sort of existential picture here, which is we're animals and we, you know, we're alive. We try to survive and reproduce, and there are challenges to our capacity to do that. And people get sick, people die. This is what it means to be a living organism. And we can do a lot to try to mitigate that and be safe. But how much are we going to turn our lives upside down to prevent something very natural from happening? And I'm wondering if that even is part of the equation with decision makers. So it may be that 70% of, you know, the population of our province, let's say, is going to end up getting the virus. And preventing that outcome would be prohibitively costly. And so I wonder to what extent the thinking is about this is sort of inevitable until there's a vaccine, and hopefully the vaccine will work and hopefully it'll come in a timely way. But a lot of people are going to get sick. That's just the reality of being a living organism. And how do we set things up so that we're preventing sort of catastrophic breakdown of our healthcare system or of social cohesion and this kind of stuff? But hey, kids are going to get sick. Adults are going to get sick. The vast majority of people are going to be fine. And let's just mitigate, test, contact trace, and, you know, sort of hope for the best and get through it until there are more practical and efficient solutions like vaccines or medications. How does that point of view land with you?
I think that I've certainly heard many, many people taking the approach of, you know, we have to get back to living life, so to speak. So that means we need to move forward. We can't, you know, stay on lockdown forever. And of course, that's true. Nobody knows for sure when a vaccine will be available and how effective it would be. So certainly living our lives on hold in lockdown for an indeterminate amount of time is not feasible or practical. And there are mental health, obviously, implications for living life in that way. At the same time, I think that it's not all or nothing, that we can resume aspects of our lives, whether it's work or whether it's school, while still adhering to practices that keep people as safe as possible, and recognizing that, again, this hasn't been sort of an equal opportunity virus insofar as we've seen in the long-term care facilities, for example, in Quebec. You know, there were systemic flaws that cost lives, and that matters, and that it hasn't just been, well, you know, this is nature. This is the nature of being a living organism, that things are going to happen and things are going to wipe things out and so on. But it's not as though that's happening in a random way. It's not random. We've seen, you know, now that there is some tracing of the difference in terms of the racial differences of who gets sick and how they get treated, or the age differences in the long-term care facilities. So it's easy to say that, I think, in many ways, that this is just part of, you know, being a living organism and these things happen sometimes. But it's easier to say that when you're not the one who's likely in the vulnerable, disadvantaged, or at-risk position through no fault of your own. So there needs to be some acknowledgement that we have a duty to protect everyone equally, and that isn't currently in place. And so there needs to be some shuffling of things, that I think that attitude doesn't recognize that fully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Let's get into some of the more practical issues here. I'd like to talk about what happens when, you know, kids and or parents are struggling with this back to school anxiety. What are the sort of early warning signs that maybe some greater level of attention is called for with a child who's having difficulty?
I have seen many families say that their children were refusing to go to school in those early days, or having meltdowns at, you know, the night before or the morning of, and really showing a lot of dysregulation and trouble regulating. They're having trouble sleeping, they're having nightmares, you know, the classic things that we might see when anxiety is present. And of course, also for the parent, right? So if parents are having trouble containing their anxiety, and then children as the barometers of stress in a family then take on that additional anxiety, and they go to school with the weight of that parent's anxiety on their shoulders, that's a problem, you know, and that needs to be addressed in some way. So whether it's the parent getting support from a friend, whether it's support from a therapist, or whether the child needs some support for that anxiety to help them go back, then, you know, those resources need to be put in place. It is difficult in a global pandemic to decide what level of anxiety is the right level of anxiety, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But again, it comes back to, as I think it always does in our profession, this idea of functional impairment, right? So if I can wear my mask, wash my hands, keep my distance from people, probably not a good time to join a choir, you know, if I can do these things and that sort of contains my anxiety, I'm still stressed and maybe, and I'm still aware of the risk, but I can engage in the things that I need to engage in, then that's something. But if I can't leave my house to get my groceries, or, you know, and there's no real health risk, you know, that I'm not a high risk person, for example, and I can't, you know, go outside of my house, even if I have a mask and if I'm careful and so on, or, you know, I'm keeping my kids away from any other human being, even if we're following proper precautions, then that level of anxiety is likely functionally impairing and it needs some support. Mm-hmm. So again, we use that notion of functional impairment to try to figure out what is just general stress in reaction to a completely stressful situation versus what is above and beyond that needs additional help.
Mm-hmm. That's a really helpful framing of that question. Tell me, what are your sort of go-to tips or strategies that you advise people to try on when they need to support their children?
as always, regulate yourself first. So as I said, making sure that your own anxiety as a parent is in check. I have had clients, you know, even last week who are saying, you know, my mother has this health condition and I'm so afraid that I'll go to school and I'll forget to put my mask back on, or I'll forget to wash my hands after eating. And they're taking on so much of that responsibility and feeling like it's their burden to keep their parents safe, and trying to help that child and that family put the responsibility where it belongs. In other words, saying, you know, your parent is aware of their health condition and they're aware of the precautions that are being taken by the school. And so if they're choosing to send you, then they are accepting that the level of risk is safe for your family, which means that they know and trust that you will do the best that you can. And especially in a child, yeah, there's going to be times that they don't remember to wash their hands, and there's going to be times that they don't put their mask on all the time. So helping that burden shift off of the child's shoulders and onto where it belongs, in terms of the responsibility. So the parent taking care of themselves, helping a child see what is in their control, what's their responsibility, and then the overall sort of wellness things that we would always talk about. So for example, can we talk about deep breathing, meditation, using a bedtime guided meditation, for example, starting the day with rituals. I think rituals are very grounding practices that help reduce anxiety and build connection, which is sort of the 1-2 punch for helping a child through any situation. So when we can, for example, start the day with saying the same thing or singing the same song to get us going in the morning, those rituals provide predictability to kids. And predictability in these ways is so necessary when so much is unpredictable about this virus and our current situation. Mm-hmm. So introducing ritual, introducing predictability, introducing meditation or deep breathing, making sure that we're moving and exercising, fresh air, getting enough sleep. So all of those foundational things that we would do to help treat anxiety in any given situation. It's just that the necessity for it right now is higher.
Really helpful. I know that you have a lot of expertise on discipline, on tools and strategies for parents disciplining their kids in efficient ways. I don't know if we can bring it in here, but I've become really curious about this distinction between co-regulation and self-regulation. And so to some extent, parents have to be there to support their kids. They have to talk to them. They have to give them hugs. They have to set up these kind of behavioral structures, like you mentioned, the routines and the rituals and this kind of stuff. But we also want our kids to develop some autonomy and self-efficacy in regulating themselves. I wonder how you kind of carve up the responsibilities here with this particular challenge, and is the framework they use for discipline relevant, right? We can't enable anxiety by catering to every need of a child who's feeling vulnerable, but we also can't push the child too much. How do you think about those issues?
It's a great question. And there's a lot, I think, embedded in there, because as you're talking, I'm also thinking about reassurance seeking and what that does to anxiety and how that factors in right now too. Mm-hmm. So I'll start with that one, because I think actually something that has come up in my clients in a lot, even in the last week. So a lot of kids right now are looking for that extra reassurance, you know, that extra 12 kisses at bedtime or at, you know, drop off, or that one extra hug. And of course, we want to nurture our kids and make them feel safe now and always. And they may be looking for an extra bit of reassurance. And so I often say, you know, if your kid says one more kiss and you can give them that extra kiss and then they go off and that's fine, great, give them that extra kiss. If that becomes not enough, right? And that one extra kiss only satisfies them for a second, they're like, no, one more and one more, or they're always upping the ante, or it becomes something that is a pattern every day that they always need the extra and the extra. That's the part that we have to be careful not to facilitate and reinforce as parents. So I might use a different strategy, like taking a piece of paper and cutting it up into 10 little squares and writing numbers 1 through 10 and, you know, a number on each piece of paper. And so we can put it in the hat and in the morning we can draw the number, and whatever number that is, that's the number of kisses we're going to get that day. Mm. And some days it's going to be 10, some days it's going to be 2. And because it's really not about the number of kisses, it's more about a child's brain creating the pattern of necessity of that number of kisses, right? So if it's 10 one day and it's 4 the other day and my child can tolerate that, we don't have an issue, right? But if my child can only tolerate 10 kisses every single day, even if it means that they're running late, or even if it means that, you know, something's in, you know, my baby's crying and I have to tend to my baby and they're still non-functional because they got 8 instead of 10, that's where we have an issue. So when we can mix it up in that way, for example, and that's, you know, maybe a simplistic example, but when we can mix it up in that way, then we're not reinforcing the anxiety in the same way as we do when we reinforce those rituals. Now, again, as I said, ritual is important, but ritual is meant to ground us and to be a connecting part of our day. But if it becomes something that my child can't go in the school if we haven't done it, and they're going to have a meltdown over it, you know, we've reached a different level. So that's sort of how I think about how do we provide that comfort and care right now while still making it flexible and not rigid and potentially negatively reinforcing anxiety-seeking behaviors. Mm-hmm. In terms of discipline more broadly and the question of co-regulation, again, it's an interesting one because I think culturally what happens is that, you know, we have babies and generally speaking, parents are pretty on board with this notion of it's my job to figure out when this baby's hungry and feed the baby and rock the baby if they need soothing or pick them up or change them if they're hot. So we're all on board for the job of regulator as parents of infants. But then something happens, like when they hit 2, when they're walking, you know, more smoothly and starting to talk a bit more, where we're like, all right, great, they're good. Mm. And we tend to forget that, yeah, their prefrontal cortex is not functional. Like they don't know how to regulate yet. And so they absolutely need our co-regulation. And if we think about the fact that, you know, these centers of the brain don't fully develop until our 20s, clearly we can't expect a 4-year-old to self-regulate all the time. I know plenty of 40-year-olds who have trouble self-regulating. So to that end, it's always our job to promote regulation. And we do that by co-regulating, certainly in the beginning, and definitely within the first 6 years, we are co-regulating. And then through co-regulating and through modeling of regulating our own emotions, then we're hoping to build that capacity on their own so that they can self-regulate. So that, you know, an 8-year-old who's upset, we might be able to just remind them or direct them to say, you know, what do you think would help you right now? You know, is it going to read in your room, or is it drawing for a bit, or do you just need some water and a snack to reset? Or should we go run around and kick the soccer ball in the backyard? And you can suggest those things in a way that just helps them tap into those resources. And they may not need you there to actually engage in that activity. But a 4-year-old sent to their room for timeout, for example, is just not reflecting on their bad behavior. That's not something a 4-year-old is doing in their room during timeout. They're reflecting on what a jerk you are for sending them to their room and how upset they are. You know, so in those moments, it's pretty clear that we have to regulate, right? And so that's what a lot of my discipline work is about, is getting rid of these notions of discipline meeting reward and punishment, and really thinking about discipline at its root, which is to teach, right? And to develop. And so we don't teach kids anything, certainly not young kids, by sending them to their room in the middle of a tantrum or meltdown to try to figure out how to calm down their brain that's just been hijacked by their, you know, as we call it, the downstairs brain, right? So when those, you know, prefrontal cortex skills, you know, the logic, reason, problem solving, those are not consistently online for kids that age, but they're certainly not online in those heightened emotional states. So they don't have access to that. And so they need us to help them regulate in those moments. And a lot of families worry about, well, what does that mean? Does that mean I'm giving them attention during these, you know, bad moments? Am I reinforcing bad behavior? I'm not saying you go out for an ice cream. I'm saying that you sit with them and hold the limit, you know, whatever it is that you, maybe they're upset because they didn't get X, or you took away Y because they weren't being safe, whatever it is, you hold the limit. That's not changing, but you can still hold the limit with compassion while also saying, you know, you got really upset when X happened. Maybe it's time for us to take some deep breaths. Do you need a hug? Would it be helpful for you to have a hug? You know, is there a book that you can look at, or we can look at together? And then when they're calmer, at another time, we can go back and revisit, you know, the infraction, if you will, or the situation, and talk about different ways to handle it or why that wasn't acceptable, and to build that understanding. But we can't build that understanding if they're not emotionally available to hear it to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I focus a lot of my attention and my work, is in helping parents shift to skill building in discipline and building regulation. Mm-hmm. So all that to say, I think it is our job to help kids learn how to regulate by modeling always throughout the lifespan, but in co-regulating during those early years, especially to promote the ability to self-regulate in kids.
That was really lovely and very articulate, and really appreciated just even kind of thinking about my own relationship with my kids as you're talking about it. And one thing that really kind of jumps out at me is just like how much the parents' self-regulatory abilities come into play. Like, you really have to be able to manage your frustration or anger or anxiety about your own child to show up for them in the right way. And so, I mean, I guess it sort of makes sense that you spend a lot of your time coaching the parents on how to do that. And I think it's really important work and great work, and I'm really grateful that you're doing it. I hope you keep doing it for a long time. I think I've taken up enough of your time. We're approaching the 1 hour mark here, so I'll let you get on with the rest of your day. Really appreciate you joining me here today, Tamara, and hope we can do it again sometime soon.
Thank you. It was a pleasure chatting with you, and I really enjoyed it.
All right. Do you want to just mention how people can find you? I know you've got a podcast, and you've got the website, which is you know, you're putting up lots of really relevant content these days. So maybe an opportunity to just mention those projects.
Thank you. Yeah. So I have been trying to put up a lot of strategies for parents in either Facebook or Instagram or Twitter. And you can find me on all of those at Dr. Tamara Souls, DR Doctor. So at Dr. Tamara Souls. And also my website, which is drtamarasouls.com. And you can find my podcast, This Hour Has 50 Minutes, also on my website or anywhere where you listen to podcasts.
Cool. And are you active on social media, or is it really the web where you're putting out most of your stuff?
Most of the stuff I put out is on social media right now. I have some courses that will be coming online likely in January. But right now, for example, I have... you know, there's a link that you can get to from my Facebook page or Instagram, where there's a little freebie handout for parents about managing anxiety in their kids. So you can find that link there. So most of it right now, the content that I put out is on social media.
And are you, again, Dr. Tamara Souls on social media, or just your first and last name?
Exactly, Dr. Tamara Souls.
Got it. Awesome. Thanks again, and talk to you soon.
Yes, thank you.
All right, take care.
Thanks for listening to the Mindspace podcast. I hope it was inspiring. If you feel the world could use a little more Mindspace, please consider supporting the podcast. The best way to do that is to leave a review on the Apple Podcast app or wherever you listen, or share your favorite episode on social media. Thanks and be well.